Americans. And so I think some kind of regulation needs to be done. I don't know exactly what that is for the public safety. In the city, if you have a 30-odd six, that might go through about a half a dozen walls before it finally stops. So if you had some burglar coming into your apartment and you blasted him, it might go through the burglar and maybe three or four of your neighbors, too. Whereas a shotgun would pretty much splatter him and not go much beyond the room there. And so there's something to be said for that kind of self-protection. I think if a person's out in the woods and so forth, far away from any police help, I think it would behoove you, if you have a family and you're concerned about them and there's problems, that you probably should think about having a gun that way. But I see that there's room for talking about some kind of licensing, some kind of learning and so forth. But my dilemma is that I have a lot of problems with the government at the same time. I mean, I don't trust, I have trouble trusting citizens, but I also have a lot of trouble trusting government. The same government that lied to us about JFK, Martin Luther King, the Gulf of Tonkin, I mean, it goes on and on. The Vietnam War, the TWA Flight 800, Waco, I mean, on and on. The government has been caught time and time and time again lying to us. We have a government that is not to be very well trusted, so I have a lot of concerns about them knowing too much about people and being in charge of such a sensitive issue. Maybe one possibility might be to license people but not guns. In other words, they might be able to look on some chart to say, yeah, John Doe there is licensed to carry a firearm, but we don't know if he has them or doesn't have them. We're getting kind of near the end of the show here. If you have any final thoughts in here, I see that I only got a very small part of the way through the pile of papers I have here. The call-in number is 464-8295, 464-8295. And so we've been discussing the movie Bowling for Columbine. And if you have any thoughts on that, please give a call. And it raises the basic question, again, why in the world are we so violent with one another? And I think that's a very deep question that needs to be answered by both sides of the gun issue. So I'd highly recommend for folks to go look at that movie. Whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun, it's definitely, you might say, swung in the direction of being anti-gun, but really he does do a good job of raising the questions of why we're so violent. He carefully examines, I couldn't say Michael Moore did anything too carefully in that film, but he did relate in depth the story of the little six-year-old boy who took a gun to school and shot another child. Obviously, at that age, the children that age have no idea of what they're doing. But he pointed out the fact that the mother had two jobs. She was being bused an hour and a half to go to those jobs, but at the same time, even though she had two jobs, she was being evicted. The little boy, obviously, in some desperate attempt to get attention from his mom, did what he did. And good evening, caller. You just have a minute or so.
Just one last thing was, if you do have a weapon, it's definitely keep it safe. Okay, thanks.
All right. That's certainly a good point there. Yes, I think if you own a gun, you certainly have a responsibility to make sure that it is stored properly, make sure that it cannot be accessed very easily by kids and so forth. And I really believe if a person is irresponsible and some tragedy happens, that person should really be held to the full extent of the law as a contributor of whatever tragedy follows. And it's not just the perpetrator of the crime. Well, again, go see that movie, Bowling for Columbine. Whether you're pro or anti gun, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit more next week. This has been Tom Clooney, and I will see you next Monday, 7 o'clock. Thank you.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But under any circumstances, we ask you to hold your calls because right now we have with us on the line, Jack Cashel, who's a video producer. In fact, he's produced an outstanding video called Silenced. And it's the story, basically, of what happened to flight TW-800. So I'm going to let him tell you a little of the story. Jack, thank you so much for being with us again this evening.
Hey, Stan, my pleasure. Anytime.
Why don't you tell us how you happened to get involved in this? Because this is sort of a... Well, had you ever done anything like this before?
Well, you know, I've produced documentaries before on all, you know, a lot of subjects, and most of them pretty straightforward, a lot of historical things, and church and tradition-related things. This was my first, you know, adventure in the world of what some might call conspiracy theorizing, a field that I had not paid much attention to before. And in fact, it's a phrase now that I reject entirely, the notion of being a conspiracy theorist. It's a way of trivializing something that has to be done and ought to be done and should have been done by the mainstream media. In this case, Stan, I was got into the game late. Now, this crash took place on July 17, 1996. And my first venture and my involvement wasn't until really the year 2001, 5 years after the fact. And I met James Sanders, who's my co-author of both of the video and the book that's coming out next month, and his wife Elizabeth. It was they who got me involved. And what intrigued me was the notion that these two, the two of the squarest, decentest, straightest, most honorable people you'd ever met, if they could be indicted, arrested, and convicted of conspiracy in this case, and spend some, at least minimal time in prison, you knew that something was wrong, that there was a lot to be hidden, And especially Liz Sanders, who was at the time of the crash a flight attendant and trainer for TWA. I mean, she lost 53 of her colleagues in the crash, was devastated by it emotionally. A lot of the people she knew personally, many of whom she had trained, one of whom had called her mother that very day and said, excited because this was her first international flight ever. Plane was on the way to Paris. And so her involvement was purely as a kind of an act of love, for her departed colleagues. And all she did was to introduce her husband, who was an investigative reporter, James Sanders, to her good friend, Terrell Stacey, who was a 747 manager, the chief pilot for the 747 line. In fact, he had flown that very plane the day before.
And, of course, he had actually provided a small piece of material from the hangar there to Jim Sanders, and that was checked out.
That's what Stacy did, right? See, Elizabeth had nothing to do with that, even, but still, just the introduction was enough to get her arrested and convicted.
Well, actually, was she actually placed in jail?
Not overnight, but, in the course of the... she had to do the perp walk a few times, handcuffed behind the back, orange jumpsuit, that whole ball of wax.
Well, I think it's so important that our listeners understand that the government did everything they could to cover up what was going on, and they tried to intimidate Mrs. Sanders and Jim Sanders for daring to question the official party line, which was a lie and designed to cover up the truth about what happened. And when the government will go to that length and bankrupt people financially with unjustified lawsuits, then you begin to realize that the power of government can be used for evil, and in this case, I think it was.
Yeah, and yet when we say government and when we say cover-up, you have to be careful here because there's only a few people who really knew what was going on. And the real culprits here, because governments are frequently corrupt. That's the nature of government, that it induces corruption, the power and implicit in it. Although the years 1993 to 2001 saw what, in my opinion, is the single most corrupt administration in American history. What the real failure was the failure of the media. This wasn't a hard case to break. If Jim Sanders and I could break it, the New York Times should have broken it 5 years ago.
Well, of course, we talked, I don't know if you know Kristen Breitweiser, but she worked for CBS as an award-winning producer for their television programs. And, of course, when she tried to bring out the truth about what happened on TW 800, she lost her job. She went... got a contract with the ABC, pressure was put on ABC not to develop this, and she became a persona non grata in television, and her crime was she tried to get out the truth. And so it goes right to the top, of ABC and CBS and NBC, who worked together to prevent the American people from ever hearing the truth.
Well, and it's not even, if they were actively conspiring, it would be more interesting than what actually happened. And that is that they're just failure to act, The New York Times is the culprit here in a sense because they were the lead reporting agency. And what you see happening is when you watch the media at work is that almost the TV networks are pretty lazy and they go after easy stuff and they go after politically correct stuff. They won't break stories on their own, especially if the New York Times isn't leading them in that direction. And since this happened in New York, You know, everyone sort of backed off and let the Times take the lead, and they would report essentially what the Times was reporting. And the Times went astray in this case because they were sort of lulled by their own access. You know, they're the New York Times. People talk to them, you know, and people lie to them. And during the, you know, in the lead up to the 1996 election, they were willing to be lied to. It's almost as if they didn't want to know the truth.
But, you know, when you were invited to go on to CNN to discuss your video, you know, a pressure, somebody said, well, you know, in the name of fairness, we can't let you go on without having somebody from the National Traffic Safety Board.
Right.
And then when they refused to go on with you, then they wouldn't let you on, but they would let the other people on. That shows, to me, a clear desire to have only one side of the story told, because you were there, you had the documentation, and they wouldn't allow your views to be put forward.
That was CNN, Stan, and you're absolutely right. I have no argument with that at all. They didn't want to hear the truth. Not after they'd invested so much of their energy in the opposite of truth. You know what I mean?
Okay, fine. Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your video? Because your video, Silence, I think really is one of the best pieces of investigative video journalism I've ever seen, especially the part where you actually take the film footage shot at the NTSB hearings, National Traffic Safety Board hearings, where they have this one gentleman, rather than bringing in the witnesses to say what they saw, why they had this man saying what the witnesses were supposed to have said they saw, and then you actually took the witnesses, you know, and showed that the man who was presenting the case was lying. And in each instance, he lied. And yet, of course, unless, of course, people were aware of the fact that they had well over 200 people who had seen the missiles going up to hit TWA-800, yet, of course, none of those people were allowed to testify. In fact, their testimony wasn't even ever given to the NTSB. Somebody blocked the FBI testimony from ever reaching the investigators.
Right. In fact, that point is well taken, Stan. In the video, when we can't, you know, it's almost comical to watch what's happening. However, you know what the irony of this all is? Is that the United States government, for all of its attempts at secrecy, has an openness about it that's mandated by law. So the NTSB is, by law, forced to post, you know, a ton of information. Not only that, you know, all I had to do was to write away to the NTSB, and they sent me, you know, like the whole six-hour taped hearing. I had to pay for it, you know, but not a lot. They also sent me the notorious CIA animation, you know, where the thing rockets upwards. So you're able to put together, I mean, 90% of all the information that's available, that exists on this case, was available to a guy on the Internet, you know, a guy who could use the Internet and wasn't afraid to call and ask for stuff. Now, and this is the beauty of it, with the Internet and with talk radio and other means of acquiring information, right now, and I mean this literally, I have more investigative power myself, sitting at home with my computer, than the New York Times entire staff did 10 years ago, in terms of my ability to secure information quickly, accurate information. So that we were able to put this information together, and just like you suggest, these ridiculous juxtapositions of what these utterly egregious lies were by this guy, his name was David Mayer, of the NTSB at the hearing, and then juxtapose them with what the eyewitnesses actually saw. And these eyewitnesses are very credible people. A lot of them are military people, people who are willing to risk their reputations to tell the truth. And that's the encouraging part of the story, just how many people were willing to do that.
Well, of course, there were actually two missiles that went up, weren't they, as far as you can tell?
As far as we can tell, there are at least two.
All right. And why don't you tell us what you've determined actually happened? Now, here we've got the TWA 800. How many people has got it? 230 people on this plane.
Right.
So what actually happened, and why is the government doing everything they can, or at least somebody doing everything they can to keep the truth from the American people?
Well, I think the two critical things to understand, Stan. One is that who is President of the United States is Bill Clinton. The other is the date that it happened. It's July 17, 1996. This is the culmination of two extremely desperate years in the Clinton White House when Newt Gingrich had taken the Congress in 1994 and just sent this utter horrible panic throughout official Washington. the last thing anyone in Washington wanted, including the media, was a Republican president for Newt Gingrich. That's setting the ground. July 17 just happened to be 2 days before the beginning of the Olympics in Atlanta, opening ceremonies, which Clinton would attend. It was 3 weeks after the bombing, the terrible bombing of Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, in which 19 American servicemen were killed. The United States military at that time was on the highest state of alert since the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was not widely known at the time. Although, curiously, I just saw Jim Kallstrom say the very same thing on the TV news just a few nights ago. He was the FBI chief on the investigation. Earlier that day, or the night before, the Islamic Change Movement, which was had taken responsibility for the Khobar Towers bombing, very credible responsibility, had faxed in a threat to the through their lead channel, which was this London-based English-language Arab paper, the biggest in the world. And it said, basically, it said at dusk that night, I expect to see a truly spectacular humiliation of the President of the United States, blah, blah, blah. And it was at dusk, exactly at dusk, that this event happened. What happened is the TWA 800 left in New York JFK Airport at 8:19, heading for Paris, traveling largely east along the Long Island coast, a little bit north. It had reached about 13,000 feet, and it kind of leveled off for a minute so that U.S. Air 217 could pass safely overhead. They were, you know, about ready to intersect, save for the 8,000 feet between them. U.S. Air was about 22,000 feet or close to it. Sitting by the window of U.S. Air, and this is probably the most critical eyewitness in the whole investigation, is a U.S. Navy Master Chief named Dwight Brumley, a total straight shooter. No one denies what he saw, and no one contradicts what he says. When he was first interviewed, it was pretty widely understood that Brumley had seen what appeared to be a flare come up off the surface of the ocean below him, head up, and then he realized when the speed and the height it was attaining, it was no flare. This is a guy with 25 years of like, intelligence, experience, training in virtually every which way in the Navy, very, very highly technical, skilled guy. And then he sees the flare arc over and start racing in the same direction as U.S. Air 217, but at a lower height. And it's going faster than 217. So Brumley says, this is no flare. And then he sees it culminate in this huge explosion. He turns to the guy behind him on the plane, a guy, Mr. Nugent, who's also talking to the FBI, and he says, did you see that? And the guy behind him says, it's incredible. Yes, and they both contact the flight attendant. Now, what was not widely known at the time, and this, in fact, I only learned after September 11th when we interviewed Brumley extensively on tape for the book, was why he was looking out the window. And we just happened to ask him that question sort of just without even thinking about it. Why were you looking out the window? What got your attention? Because he's looking out towards the east, towards the darkness, and on this plane, 217, which is heading largely north. And he says, well, it's a small plane. I told the FBI that. We said, what small plane? He said, it was a small, like a private plane, maybe a six-seater, a single engine, heading straight at U.S. Air 217. Missed us by about 300 or 400 feet. When I saw it, I said, oh, my God, what is that? And then he said, 15 seconds later, I see this flare come up off the surface. Well, we go back and check his FBI 302, his witness statement, and sure enough, the FBI recorded that as well, 3 or 4 days after the crash. They interviewed him for a half hour. The most key eyewitness in the whole investigation was interviewed once in Florida by the local FBI agent for a half hour. The CIA never talked to him, and the NTSB never talked to him, even though they would both base much of their testimony on what Brumley alleged to see or didn't see. No one wanted to talk to him again, mainly because he knew too much. That small private plane holds the secret to what happened to TWA Flight 800. Everyone acknowledges that it was there. The NTSB, the FBI, and the CIA. They know it was there because Brumley saw it, and no one contradicts them. They know it was there because it left a very definitive radar track on the screen.
And so the radar track is available then.
It is available, and they all admit it. I mean, in their documentation, the CIA says, yes, Brumley saw the plane. Yes, it left the radar track.
Now, did it have a transponder on?
No, if it did, it was off.
It's not registering. Now, I think for the listener out there, the transponder is a sort of a radio beacon that the airplane is supposed to carry, and that way it can be tracked by the air traffic control.
Right.
If you don't want to be tracked, you turn off your transponder, but you're not supposed to do that.
Exactly, especially when you're flying in the midst of commercial aviation like that. Now, the transponder would tell the automatically tell the flight controllers the number of the plane. They tell them exactly what plane that is. So that the radar track that this little plane left, the private plane left, was like what they call a primary radar track. And that is, you just see a track, you don't know what it is.
No, because you commented, you thought this was a private jet of some sort?
Yes, because it was flying at 22,000 feet.
Which you wouldn't normally see, you know, a regular plane, you know, a propeller-driven plane flying that high.
No, it was most likely like a Learjet or something like that. I mean, and Brumley didn't see it all that well, but I mean, it's dark, it's night, and it's going fast, but he saw it well enough to get some sense of its size and proportion.
Did the pilot, anybody ever talk to the pilot about this near miss? I mean, this is would be a frightening thing for the pilot.
Well, you would think they would have, wouldn't you? You would also think, you know, the FBI said that the small plane was a small commuter airliner, right? Now, a commuter airliner would have a transponder, would have a pilot, and would have crew, would have passengers. And you'd think that they would all be investigated because no one would have had a better view on what happened to Flight 800 than this plane that was heading, you know, that was just above and of the whole crash site, you know, where everyone on the right side of the plane would have clearly seen what happened to Flight 800. For some reason, these people were never interviewed or identified. They don't exist because they don't exist. That's why they don't. Now, the FBI said it was that. Now, the CIA is interesting here because when they made this notorious cartoon in 1997 to close the case, the FBI showed it.
Now, this is the one that was shown to all across America.
That's right.
To try to give the perception for the American people that, you know, the nose fell off, there was an explosion in the center fuel tank, the nose falls off, the plane starts to rise and fly up in the air and then crashes down, which, of course, the whole thing is totally ridiculous, but they've got to convince the American people that truth is falsehood, and so the CIA goes to great lengths to come together with a cartoon,
right,
and they get it distributed all across America to control our reality. So pick up the story from there.
Well, that's right, Stan. In fact, but the amazing thing is they only show it once because it was so ludicrous, the aviation community went berserk, and they wouldn't even show it at the FBI hearings a week later. But what they showed it just enough to leave the impression that what these people saw, the 700-something eyewitnesses, wasn't a missile ascending, but rather a noseless airplane that had turned into like a rocket, and that after its nose fell off, this huge 747 was missing his whole front third of the plane, bolted upright and flew up straight 3,500 feet. I mean, it is, I think, personally I think this, and I'm not exaggerating here, probably the single greatest lie ever perpetrated on the American people in peacetime. And the odd thing about it, though, in regards to the little plane that we were just talking about, is that in the animation, they show the plane just as Brumley described it. That is, it's a small kind of private plane flying right under U.S. Air 217. I mean, they lower it a little bit, so it doesn't seem like it's about ready to collide, but it's there, as described, as Brumley describes it, right?
I'm sorry. Now, 217 is where Brumley is, and he's 8,000 feet above. So that is way above the TW-800.
Right, but this small private plane is just a few hundred feet below him.
Right.
See? And they show it. The CIA, in their animation, they show it from Brumley's perspective. They show the small plane as he describes it, and they show it going under 217. They lower it, and it's just sort of inconsequential in the whole retelling of the story, but it's there. Now, a year and a half later, the NTSB, and like I said, there's some straight shooters in the NTSB. The rank and file of the NTSB are fine. They're not in on this. They want to get at the truth like everyone else does. And they finally convince their superiors that they need to interview these CIA analysts who made this ridiculous video and to find out what guided their thinking. So this whole conversation is documented, by the way. It's on the Internet if you want to find it, word for word. Fascinating document. The one document that blows open the whole case. In this, one of the NTSB agents finally asked the CIA guys, he says, okay, well, tell us about that plane that Dwight Brumley saw. What plane was that? And the CIA guy says, yeah, he did see it. It did leave a radar track, but we believe that it was the Navy Orion P-3, P-3 Orion.
Well, now, that is not a little plane. It's a big plane, isn't it?
It's a huge plane. It's, it's got four engines. It's got a 95-foot wingspan. There's no way in God's green earth that a 25-year Navy vet could have confused that with a small private plane. Just didn't happen. Plus, we know from the radar that it was flying several miles behind, but in the same direction as the small plane that Brumley saw.
So there was an Orion there.
Oh, it was
so there. There were two planes there that nobody's ever talked about before.
No, and they were there. And the Orion also, this is bizarre, had its transponder off, okay? The P-3 had its transponder off. When the P-3 crew was interviewed by the FBI early in the investigation, when the FBI was still trying to get at the truth, the P-3 crew told them that, and they also repeated this to the NTSB, that their transponder broke en route to this exercise that they were going to have. Now,
they were going to have an exercise, in other words, some sort of a military exercise, and yet the Navy repeatedly denied there was an exercise in that area, didn't they?
Well, the Navy's denied a lot. They denied that there were any ships in that area first, and for 6 months they kept up that facade. But what's amazing about this is that here you have a high-tech surveillance airplane, filled with electronic gizmos up and down, and this transponder breaks, and we're supposed to believe this? Well, with a broken transponder, though, that means they can move the P-3 any place they have to move it, when it comes time to talking about where it was. So that's what, then they try to pass it off, and the CIA says, here it is, three years after the thing, the most critical plane in the whole mix, and the CIA says, analyst says, I believe it was the Navy P-3 Orion. Believe? You mean after 3 years and $50 million worth of analysis, you believe it was the P-3 Orion? At that point, the NTSB guy, the NTSB brass, not the rank and file, intervene and say, you don't want to go there. You don't remember that well. He tries to steer him away from that P-3 answer. Well, it's curious because a year later, when the NTSB gives its final hearing, now they're saying they're sure it was the Navy P-3. And it wasn't. They knew it. Everyone knew it wasn't.
So what was the little plane, and why was the P-3 there following the little plane?
Well, I will. I'm moving into the area of speculation. I'm going to tell you what the evidence suggests, but I can't prove it right now. I'll be honest with you. I could prove to you that the plane mechanical failure did not bring that plane down, and the explosion was on the exterior.
You're talking about the TW-800 did not come from an explosion in the center fuel tank,
no.
As they've spent so much money trying to convince us actually occurred.
Right.
Now, what about Boeing? Does Boeing believe in this explosion theory, or have they simply want to get along with government, get government contracts, so they're just going to sort of squash their investigation? Where do we stand there?
On Boeing, it's just like TWA. They really don't have a choice. When the government says that this happened, it happened. They have too much at stake.
Sort of like getting an offer from the mafia. You can't very well refuse.
Right. You won't find a rank-and-file engineer at Boeing. You won't find a mechanic at TWA or a pilot who believes it is mechanical failure. If this is a conspiracy theory, they've managed to convince thousands of America's best aviation people. Just to get back quickly to that, to the P-3 and that small plane, it seems that small plane holds the secret to why TWA-800 went down that night. They need to account for it. Best evidence suggests that was a small terrorist airplane filled with about 1,000 pounds or more of high-energy explosives that, in fact, was hit by one of the missiles that the U.S. Navy fired at it, and the striking of that plane took place in relatively close proximity to flight TWA flight 800, close enough to the blue planes, both of them out of the sky.
Well, do you believe then that both missiles were Navy missiles?
Yes.
Okay, and there was a terrorist, and of course, there was no question that terrorists had threatened to bring down our planes.
Right, and they also took credit the next day. It was, you know, people say, how come if there was a terrorist, how come there's no claims of responsibility? Well, there are many claims of responsibility. Anyone want to check? All you have to do is read the one honest day of reporting on this case, which is July 18th, 1996. Go to the New York Times, Newsday, CNN, wherever, and you will read an entirely different story than you do on July 19th.
Well,
this will go away when the terrorists go away, when the threats go away, when the warnings go away. It all goes away after the 18th. But on the morning of the 18th, you're getting honest reporting.
Of course, we carry the book Bin Laden, The Man Who Declared War Against America.
Right, and you know what Podansky says.
Sure, and he says, the Islamists in London said, we did it.
Yep.
And of course, then how could you conceal that from the American people? You've got to have a lot of clout to be able to remove that fact from the reality of the American people and make them believe that black is white, white's black, and of course, the good times will go on forever.
Well, you know, and it really comes down to, Stan, this, you know, sounds simplistic, but it really comes down to the New York Times in this case, if you watch the way it works. And
we're going to have to interrupt you there because we got to go to a break.
Okay, very good.
Because we don't, we're going to be in real trouble here. So we're going to have to, we're talking with Jack Cashel tonight. His video is called Silence. It's the finest video that we have on the Downing of TW800. Fascinating watching, professionally done, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs on a regular basis to help us do what we do 5 hours a day, and that our Saturday programs heard on some 36 stations, something like that, every weekend. And we have an opportunity to get the truth out to people across America, but quite frankly, we need your help to do what we do. So if you believe there's a problem, you believe we're really involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, and there really are some things going on that the American people are not being told or told clearly, we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And so if you would like to join with us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation can continue, whether a nation created in freedom can long survive, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our October newsletter, which really covers what happened on 11 September from the point of view of Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband, Ron Breitweiser, died in the South Tower. And, of course, this is a testimony that was given before the Senate Select Committee on the 18th of September, Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, on the 18th of September of this year. And the video cameras were there, and the television cameras were there, and the motion picture cameras were there, and the reporters were there, and nobody bothered to report what she really said. So if you'd like to read the complete text, that's our October newsletter. And if you haven't had one of our newsletters before, we'll be glad to send you a free copy. And I think you'll find it fascinating to get her view, Kristen Breitweiser's view, of what really took place on the 11th of September of last year when her husband perished. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And if you'd like to know more about the video we're talking about, it is an outstanding video. It really should have gotten all sorts of awards and should be certainly on something that everybody sees. But unfortunately, it hasn't had the coverage it should have had every time that Jack Cashel was invited on CNN to discuss it. Why, at the last minute, he was disinvited, told that he couldn't come on in the name of fairness. Of course, we couldn't have you come on in the name of fairness. If you'd like to know how you might get that, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Again, the name of the video is called Silence, and that really is what it's all about. There's been an effort to silence the truth about what happened to TW800 and why those 230 people died that day. Well, Dr. Stan, back here, and remember our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, Jack is telling us the amazing story. There were two other planes that were there. And, of course, he believes that the smaller plane was loaded with explosives. And did they anticipate then that that plane would be crashed into TW-800 or what?
Those kind of operations, you don't crash into necessarily. All you got to do is get close. And I just want to go back to the night of July 17th, 1996, and explain what happened immediately after the crash, because this is a testimony, I think, to why the thesis I just advanced has some merit, has a lot of merit. Immediately after the crash, official Washington went into a virtual state of war. Now, this didn't happen 3 months earlier with the Value Jet crash in Florida. I mean, it doesn't usually happen when a plane crashes. But it did this night. Within an hour and a half, there are at least 40 high-level authorities from various branches of security branches meeting in the Situation Room of the White House. What triggered this wasn't the eyewitness reports, because those trickled in. They came in slowly, and no one exactly knew, you know, how valid they were. What triggered it was this. Two high-level senior FAA technicians, air traffic control people out of New York, saw an object merge with Flight 800 at the second it exploded, or, you know, virtually merge with Flight 800. And
did they see this on radar or what?
On radar as it was happening. And what they did is they immediately were alarmed, especially since Flight 800 disappeared. And it disappeared without leaving any, without the pilot saying anything to anyone. Now, it almost never happens in a mechanical-induced crash that there's no final word. Usually they have, you know, pilots have, you know, minutes, seconds, certainly, to alert, you know, their fellow pilots and the ground control that they're in trouble. No mayday, no nothing. Just quick, disappeared. Now, upon seeing this, what they did is they did what they were supposed to do. They rushed the tape to the FAA headquarters in Atlantic City, New Jersey, probably about 100 miles south. And then from there, they immediately sent it to, copies of it certainly, to the Situation Room in the White House, where they had copies of it by 10 p.m. that night, 90 minutes after the crash, where official Washington was in a state of a war. I mean, they admit it. At least, you know, the insiders do. That's how, yeah, they admit it. I mean, there's no hiding that. That's not well known, but, you know, the people who were there say that quite openly.
Well, now, were you able to act off the record to get some of the people to give you any of the background on this?
Well, I didn't have to, because here's where I had an advantage, and a lot of people who've investigated this didn't bother to look, and that is that there were two mainstream reporters who wrote books on TWA Flight 800. One is Pat Milton, who wrote a book called In the Blink of an Eye. AP reporter. The other one is Christine Negroni, who wrote a book called Deadly Departure. She's a CNN reporter.
The blink of an eye?
Yeah. Each of them had, Pat Milton had total access to the FBI in writing her book. Christine Negroni had total access to the NTSB. They told her, both of them, their stories. And of course, they're laundering huge parts of it to make it palatable. But the early stories, they match. They syncopate. This is what was happening.
Now, what was the title of the second book?
The second book is called Deadly Departure.
Okay.
And since the authorities knew that both of these women were going to write official government stories, they were willing to share with them a lot of firsthand information that no one would have ever told me. I can tell you that. And their accounts track, and their accounts are, you know, artless in those first, you know, couple hours. They don't realize what they're revealing, in a sense, because what they're giving away are the contradictions that are rife throughout this case. Let me give you one, for instance. Both Negroni and Milton acknowledge that the highest state of alert since Cuban Missile Crisis, after the fact that FAA technicians send their tapes down there, the nation's in a state of war, blah, blah, blah. Okay, they acknowledge that, but what they don't square is this, that the P-3 pilots, the very next day, tell the FBI, and in the first few days, the FBI was serious about solving this problem. They tell the FBI that right after the crash, you know, after circling around for a while looking for survivors, that, by the way, they see or hear nothing about this crash, even though they're only a mile away in their high-level security surveillance plane, you know, who's done total service in the Balkans where they were responsible for monitoring hundreds of square miles of operation. Immediately after this crash, official Washington in a state of war, right? You're right in the area. You're a super high-level surveillance plane. And what do? And they said, they tell the FBI, and Pat Milton and Negroni report this as though it were gospel without seeing the contradiction. Well, they said, well, we went on to complete our exercises with the sub, the USS Trepang, 200 miles south off the coast of Virginia. Oh, okay. So the United States is in a virtual state of war. We're on a total alert for terrorists, and our best asset is down doing sub-exercises 200 miles away? No, this doesn't happen. You know, someone alert these people here. You know, just look for your own internal inconsistencies. And then, of course, they can't get their story straight. So the P-3 pilots first tell the FBI that they were 100 miles away off the coast of New Jersey, 80 miles away. Then they tell the NTSB they were 200 miles away because the Navy started putting out the story they had no assets within 200 miles. So they had to move the sub to Trepang 200 miles away, you know. They can't get the story straight. And then there's poor Pat Milton, the author of The Blink of the Eye. She has the coordinates. She says it was 80 miles away off the coast of Manasquan, New Jersey. Well, I grew up around the coast of Manasquan, New Jersey. I know it well. And then she cites the coordinates that the FBI gave her. Well, the coordinates put them off the coast of Virginia. I mean, so everything is a lie. Everything is wrong, you know. The Navy goes for 6 months, and they tell everyone who'll listen, and they're not acting on their own impulses. They're under total orders to do this. They say they don't have any asset within 200 miles, actually about 185 miles, of the crash site, right? 16 months later, at the final FBI hearing, the FBI admits that, yes, there were four naval assets within 6 miles of the crash site when it happened.
So obviously they've been lying and lying and lying.
Lying and lying, so that it doesn't even make any sense to ask these people anymore, you know? I mean, I'd rather go back in and just check their official documentation, what they said on the record. I mean, I could go ask them now, the Navy, and they just lie to me some more. So, you know, there's not much point in that. But the lying of the Navy on this point, and like I say, I think they were under a national security shutdown. I think they were told to do this. I don't think they were committing a crime. I mean, I think they thought they were doing the right thing, and I think they thought they were doing it for the right reasons. And I'm almost positive this order came from the top. It had to have, because it was coordinated across just about every kind of battle sector there was. They are consciously and totally fabricating a story about where their assets were that night. And, you know, and then when they started to untell the story, which they did gradually over time, and finally admitting that they had at least four assets, major assets, within 6 miles of the crash site, as they admitted at the FBI hearing, finally, the media don't pick it up. They don't say, hey, you know, just a year ago, you were saying you had no assets within 200 miles, and now you're saying you have four within 6 miles. You know, why did you lie to us before? This question is never asked. What's amazing, Stan, is now that, you know, you can, you know, download all the New York Times articles and then do a word search on them, it's really the technology available to just amateurs like myself is hugely superior than what it was. The New York Times did not use the word military in the first 6 months of their investigation. The word just doesn't cross their lips. After July 18th, the word missile disappears for a month. The word eyewitness disappears for a month. It's like reporting that, you know, it's like Orwellian reporting, Alice in Wonderland reporting. But right. I'm not telling you something you don't know.
No, but you go right ahead. Oh, we've got somebody on the line here. Let's just see who's calling in.
Okay.
Who's calling in? Hello, who's this? Is somebody on the line? No, they're not there any longer. Okay, go ahead.
Well, so it's a story filled with, and doing the investigation into it, and I spent, Jim Sanders was my guide and my mentor on this project. I did most of the writing in the book, and he kind of led me to the documentation and said, jump in, see what you can find. Well, I spent 4 months every day, and every day was like a eureka day. Every day you find a new discovery, a new treasure, just a new, this mind-blowing detail that you could not believe they'd leave in the official record.
Now, what you really believe is that this small plane was hit by a missile in proximity to TW-800, and, of course, that had some impact on the plane, but you believe the second Navy missile actually hit the plane, is that it?
I believe that actually the first Navy missile hit the plane.
Okay.
Based on the debris field, it seems entirely
right.
Clear that the first missile, and these were only a second or two apart, I mean, they were that close. These are, and I can't say exactly what kind of missile they were, probably radar guided or, you know, but they, if this plane were diving, as it probably was, from up, you know, near 217, making a big loop coming down parallel and under and flight 800, missiles were probably being, you know, pulled by the, you know, the sudden change in trajectory. The first missile hits 217, hits flight 800 rather, on the right wing, leaves explosive residue over the right wing and inside along the right wing, throughout the seats, leaves a trace throughout the passenger cabin as it races through. May not have been catastrophic. The plane, Flight 800, may have survived that. Certainly it would have limped along for a little while. What was catastrophic was the second blast, which everyone, the eyewitnesses who could tell, described as a huge, bright, white light that they could not describe, much bigger than the first blast, underneath the plane. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, and hats off to these guys, the only honest report publicly filed, they said outright, in their report, you can just go on the NTSB website right now and read it if you want to, they said that there was no electrical problem, there was no problem in the wiring, they said there was no problem in the design. They said what happened was there was a huge explosion outside the fuselage that unzipped the fuselage. And they say that plain and that simple. All evidence suggests that there was a huge, huge blast underneath and to the left of the plane that blew the nose off the plane, bucked it upright, and then just made it fall out of the sky like a dead duck, you know, that had just been shot. One other fascinating detail in the interview between the NTSB rank-and-file guys and the CIA analysts. Again, this is all documented word for word. The NTSB analyst asked the CIA guy, they say, hey, listen, you know, if there was an onboard explosion, this fuel tank overpressure that you say, it would not have been able to shake a steel bridge, a 70-ton steel bridge 10 miles away, as everyone acknowledged happened. And the CIA guy says, well, that's true. In fact, they acknowledge you couldn't shake a steel bridge a mile away, let alone 10 miles away. But the CIA guy responds with an interesting responder. He says, well, neither could a missile warhead. And the NTSB guy says, you're right. And then you're thinking to yourself, okay, if the missile warhead couldn't do it and the fuel tank explosion couldn't do it, what did cause this 70-ton steel bridge to shake 10 miles away? Well, the NTSB guy says, I've been doing my homework. And he goes, you know, what I've discovered is that it would take 1,000 pounds of high-energy explosives at 10 miles to shake a steel bridge. At which point,
thank you for calling KFDR Radio 89.9.
At which point, the NTSB brass jump in and say, okay, we've explored this enough, let's move on. You know?
Okay, in other words, somebody there in the NTSB did not want to get any further and didn't want to get that on the record.
Right. You have to understand, too, Stan, that on the day of this explosion, Ramzi Youssef was standing trial in New York City for the Bojinka plot.
And, of course, he was the mastermind behind the attack on the World Trade Center. And,
right.
Right.
And he knew how to stuff 1,000 pounds of explosives into a vehicle. He'd done it in New York. His laptop computer seized in the Philippines. He had plans to take small private planes, charter planes, fill them with high-energy explosives, and use them as flying bombs. It's all there. It was there in 1995.
Sure. Okay, who do we have on the line?
It's Mike in Santa Cruz.
Hi, Mike in Santa Cruz. You have a question or comment?
Yes, Dan, a question. We've heard a lot this evening about how the whole thing happened regarding Flight 800. But why? And who might have been on the airplane who might have been a target, who somebody wanted dead?
Well, I would say this, is that there was no one on that plane worthy of their own missile. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. I think Flight 800 just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, you believe that the Islamist radicals wanted to bring down a plane to create an incident.
Yes, and they would have been, I think they would have been satisfied with any plane they could bring down.
Well, if that was the case, why would it be a Navy missile?
An Islamic terrorist would not shoot an Islamic missile at a missile at an Islamic plane.
No, but Mike, the thing is that what Jack is suggesting is that we knew that they were going to be doing this. We had our subs or vessels there, and of course they were tracking this terrorist plane, and of course we shot missiles hoping to bring it down. Is that pretty much what you're saying, Jack?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that we knew this in advance. I would say that we picked it up in process, and when this P-3 was following a small plane right in the commercial airspace without a transponder, and then they saw it just buzz 217, you know, almost hit it, and then dive at Flight 800, they waited 15 seconds until it cleared 217, according to Dwight Brumley. That's when he saw the missile come up. I think they decided they didn't have any choice, that it was the only thing they could do, and I think they were right. I think the Navy did the right thing. The results weren't... what they had hoped, obviously, but even if they hadn't pulled the trigger, the results probably would have been the same. Now,
no, but you're saying that because they did pull the trigger, why the White House decided to cover it up, because it wasn't too long, but we were going to be having elections, and
right.
Bill Clinton didn't want the bad publicity.
No, I mean, let's face it, he's running on, everyone knows he's a sleazeball, but he says, hey, I've given you 4 years of peace and prosperity. Well, the next day, if the truth were known, we would have had no peace and no prosperity, because the FAA told the White House that night, July 17th, that if this were a terrorist, we're going to have to shut down East Coast traffic. That means no Olympics. That means the kind of economic crisis we saw after September 11th, and no peace. Now, if you were an honorable president, it would not necessarily have had a negative effect on his popularity, but he's not an honorable president. He's polling every day to see, I mean, he polled on Khobar Towers to see how he should respond, you know, which is appalling. And he understood that, you know, he at that point, he had like a 20-point lead over Bob Dole. He doesn't need this. This is the only kind of catastrophe that could derail him.
Well, now, what's the relationship between the downing of TW-800 and the bomb that went off at the Olympics?
That's an excellent question. I'm of the opinion, based on the way the government handled it, that bomb was a terrorist bomb.
Right, of course, but how long after that? Was it what?
That happened on July 28th, which was 11 days later.
11 days later, okay.
Who was the terrorist?
In Atlanta, you mean?
No, this whole thing ties into this whole Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, because they were making these threats all the time. They said they were going to bring down one of our planes. They were going to be setting off these terrorist bombs in the United States to, of course, attack America in reprisal because the infidels were occupying the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. And yet, and it's so murky in there, Stan, as you know. An interesting book to read is Laurie Milroy's book, The War Against America.
Right.
And she tracks the first World Trade Center bombing through Iraq. And she believes that Ramzi Youssef was an Iraqi agent. In fact, he was known on the ground in New York as Rashid the Iraqi. I would not be surprised if Iraq were behind this. One clue is this, is you know how date-conscious they are. You know, they do things in celebratory ways. So the first World Trade Center bombing occurred on the second anniversary of the last day of the Gulf War. Prominent day in the Iraqi revolutionary calendar, the one that's their Bastille Day, their 4th of July, is July 17th. It's the day the Baath power, Hussein's party took power. That's the day this took place. However, I mean, that's that much being said. you know, if there was some other mischievous terrorist involved who wanted to throw the suspicions of Iraq, that would be one hell of a day to do it.
No,
I don't think that day's an accident, though.
All right, fine. And July 17th, then, was the day that CWA was brought down?
Right.
Okay. Anything else, Mike?
Well, a few things. Your guest just spoke of Iraq being behind something. I think the next question must be, who's behind Iraq?
No, that's
and,
of course
certain people in New York and Washington D.C. are behind Iraq, and
well,
then also the terrorists behind the Atlanta Olympic bombing. That's what I was trying to ask before. Things were going pretty fast in the discussion here. Who would be that terrorist?
I don't know. I do know that, though. You know, we know that first they tried to pin it on the stupid Richard Jewell, poor guy. And then the next thing they tried to pin it on an abortion, anti-abortion mythical figure called Eric Rudolph. Now, the thing is, why would an anti-abortion protester blow up the Atlanta Olympics?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. Well, what they tried to do, as they did in Oklahoma City, was to exploit it for political purpose.
I think the one thing they wanted to do was not let the American people realize the Islamic involvement in that.
I think you're right. I mean, just like they did in Oklahoma City. I mean, once they found Timothy McVeigh, they had their poster boy right wing. They exploited the hell out of it. For the first time in years, Clinton climbed above 50% approval ratings as on the back of Oklahoma City, and he never looked back. He attributed his re-election to that. To that bomb himself,
okay.
To a group of reporters in an honest moment. He was expert in milking tragedy. He did it in Flight 802, went up to the hangar a week after the fact, and just so happened they found the black boxes that very day, just as he arrived. Even though they were sitting on the ocean floor in 130 feet of water, it took them 8 days to find them. Doesn't happen. Every detail, every bit of evidence in the Flight 800 is tainted. It has to be. When you change a terrorist attack into a mechanical failure, you've got to corrupt every single bit of evidence.
Okay, well, we're out of time, Mike. Thanks so much. And right now, of course, we're just about out of time for Jack Cashel, who is, of course, the producer of the video Silenced, and must-seeing for anybody who really wants to understand the lengths that they went to deceive the American people.
And keep an eye out for our book, First Strike, which will be out in February.
I hope you're going to get us one, and then we can get you on again, and we can cover the same material. Well, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, I would just say this, is that, you know, I would always be suspicious of everything you read and everything you hear. But I would be just as suspicious of the New York Times as you are of a person like myself, except more so. Check it out for yourself. During the Clinton years, anything that he was accused of could possibly have happened. But I think the Clinton years were an anomaly. I don't think they were the norm. And I would also be not. I see a little too much paranoia today, too. I mean, you can't attribute every horrible thing to some, you know, utter deep conspiracy involving the Rockefellers. Although they're, you know, capable of a lot of bad stuff. Just be careful and use your own good judgment.
All right, Jack. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Okay, you too, Stan. Take
bye-bye.
Care.
Okay, bye-bye. Fine. And that's Jack Cashel, of course, and we're talking about his video, Silence, which is a must viewing for anybody who's concerned about what happened or would like to get the truth of what really happened that day. And the one thing is very, very obvious. There was an Islamic terrorist plot to blow up the World Trade Center in February of 1993, and that was covered up by the government. There was efforts to cover up the Islamic involvement with the Oklahoma City bombing. There was an honest cover-up the Islamic involvement at the downing of TW 800. Why would that be? Why would that be after we knew Osama bin Laden was involved with all these things? Why the administration, Clinton administration refused to accept him when the Sudanese government wanted to turn him over to us in 1996? Something's wrong. Well, we're out of time, and so until tomorrow, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America and pray for our ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Don Fife, and Don has a fascinating story to tell about the people who are from the government who are here to help us. Don, thank you so much for being with us.
Good evening, Stan.
And, of course, you've had a lot of run-ins with the people from the various government departments who've been intent upon taking away your property rights. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and this incredible, incredible story?
Well, I'm an environmentalist, an economic geologist. I've been practicing for more than 20 years with the government.
Are you on a regular handheld radio? Pardon me, regular handheld telephone?
Right.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Anyway, I've been a geologist working in government for about 14 years, private practice and academia, where I taught geology, including environmental geology. But I happen to be from a family of small miners. And, in fact, my family's been in California for several generations. One ancestor was in the Portola Expedition in 1769 that found San Francisco Bay, as a matter of fact. Mariano Verdugo. But other than that, I'm just a working geologist, and I took over my family's mining business when my parents got too old to operate it after I left government.
What was the mine? What did they mine?
They were mining calcium carbonate.
Okay.
And for people who are not familiar with that term, it's basically Tums, the antacid you buy at the pharmacy. And it's in virtually every product in some manner, either to process it or its filter extender. And calcite limestone is not just plain limestone. I went to the University of Dayton years ago, and back there, there's limestone everywhere. Most geology is limestone and glacial till, but that limestone is not real pure. Some places that they can make cement out of it, and occasionally there's a pure place, but there's only five areas in the United States where there's enough high-grade calcite to mine economically. And one of those is in Southern California. In fact, it's the principal source for the Western United States. And there's a cement plant there and a couple of large mining operations. And my family got involved because my father started looking for gold back in after the Second World War. And we were given a little gold mine by a friend. And we kept having a problem with this white rock covering up the gold ore. So we would drill and blast 20, 30 tons, and we'd get a couple hundred pounds of gold ore. Oh, gosh, it was really good. It actually went broke because of all this overburden. So my dad went into hauling materials, and pretty soon he was hauling limestone, a calcite limestone, from an area about 15 miles east. And it wasn't as good as what we were throwing away. So suddenly a light bulb came on, and we decided maybe the limestone was worth something. And it turned out this stuff was very high grade. It ran 98-99% calcium carbonate, which is equivalent to Tums. Tums is only 98%. So we were just a family business. We had a small sand and gravel business as well. And we had so much opposition from the government and from various environmental groups that we could not get into production for a number of years in that location. And eventually I was the appraiser of Kaiser Steel's in the bankruptcy of Kaiser Steel's iron mine back in the early 80s, and my father had sold a portion of her deposit to Kaiser Steel. So I was doing the appraisal in the bankruptcy and also trying to sell iron ore in the world market, keep the mine open. And having been a president of a local government employees union, the union folks at Kaiser, they kept contact with me because I thought maybe we could save their jobs by selling iron ore in the world market, even though the steel mill was being forced out of business. And it turns out we couldn't do that, but I told them that if, in fact, in the bankruptcy they got this little parcel my father had sold Kaiser back in 1958, that I had recently patented the extension, actually a larger portion of the deposit, and we should put the two deposits together if they got it in the bankruptcy. Well, they did get it in the bankruptcy.
Don, I'm going to ask you to hang up. I'm going to call you right back because we've just got a terribly poor line here. So you just hang on. I'll call you right back in just a moment, okay?
Okay.
Okay. And we'll be here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. I just want to get a little clearer signal for you. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and let's go to our special guest. Don, why don't you go ahead and tell the story?
Okay, well, anyway, the bottom line on this particular deposit, we finally, after 26 years, with 5,000 AFL-CIO, United Steel Workers of America, health insurance beneficiaries, cut through the red tape, and that deposit got into production, but it took 26 years. And we are in production there. It's the Vision Insurance Fund, the steel workers that lost their jobs when Kaiser was put out of business by Japanese dumping and the Brown administration's overzealous environmental regulations. So it turns out the Kaiser workers wound up with about 10,000 acres of limestone mining claims in the San Bernardino Mountains. And aside from the little operation we have with them, they sell to AMIA, which is a worldwide large producer, and to Pfizer, their spin-off Specialty Minerals, and to Mitsubishi. So the steelworkers are supplying limestone to a number of the organizations there. And we have another family property we worked on for 40 years on the east end of the district. And we spent about 30 years getting it ready for production. In 1990, we put in for the final permits to operate there. And this is on the backside of the... Well, right away, it turns out the Forest Service was unnecessarily obstructive. And first, they had some weeds that they, one of their botanists decided were limestone endemic. In other words, they only grow on high-grade limestone, the mineral that we're all mining there. Very convenient. And eventually, they got those listed as endangered in 1993 with virtually no scientific data. It's basically speculation. The botanist, Tim Krantz, that was involved in this originally, he was given jobs to look at limestone mines and do a floral and fauna list. And, of course, he was only looking at limestone properties, and came up with the idea, well, gee, these only go at limestone deposits. And basically, this information was used by the Forest Service with no real scientific research, just internal reports. I've never seen a peer-reviewed scientific journal report that substantiates this. So that suddenly we have an area on the north side of the San Bernardino Mountains that the Forest Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife say has these endangered plants.
Well, now, of course, why are they so intent upon cutting you down?
Well, I think it's very obvious that the policy of the Forest Service, at least this forest and many others, is they don't want any mining. They want to stifle mining.
In other words, this is all part of the sustainable development. We're going to shut everything down for future generations, or I just shut everything down.
This is what the Unabomber wanted. He wanted to destroy industrial civilization as we know it.
And we've got a lot of Ted Kaczynski's working for government agencies. After all, Ted Kaczynski had a copy of Al Gore's book, Earth in the Balance, in his cabin. Nobody ever mentioned that. All they ever did was talk about Timothy McVeigh's Turner Diaries, but nobody ever pointed that Ted Kaczynski had a well-read and underlined copy of Earth in the Balance, which is really this whole junk ecology movement.
Well, this is part of the Wildlands Project, which, of course, Ted was much in favor of, to turn 50% or more of the United States into human exclusion wildernesses with interconnecting corridors for wildland to roam across the continent. And so we're just one little microcosm. Now, the Forest Service has been promoting a weed and arroyo toad sanctuary.
All right, fine. Well, of course, then, did you take legal action against them to try to stop them from doing this?
Well, they put our little proposed operation into wilderness with the Dianne Feinstein S-21 Desert Wilderness Bill, which was signed by Bill Clinton.
Well, then did they buy your property from you?
Oh, no. They just want to put you out of business. In fact, at the time this was going on, I was opposing this along with a lot of other desert residents and folks. And the Forest Service staff decided to help Dianne out, so they brought the Marines in on the 14th of September 1991 during the middle of fire season, and there was a rock cabin, the oldest historic rock cabin in the region, a place called Horse Thief Flat.
Now, was this your cabin, or who did it belong to?
No, it belonged to you and I, the public. It was a historic cabin. The mining camp dated from 1859. The Forest Service has had a policy for years of burning down old mining camps, but they've been made out of wood or to bulldozing them. This was a rock cabin with a metal roof. It wouldn't burn easily. So they had the Marines come in under the guise of interdicting drugs. And a friend of mine was there that day, Dr. Martin Stout, who is the chairman of the geology department at Cal State LA, with two students, and he was run out by the Forest Service, who had the Marines accompanying them, and two families from the Victorville four-wheel drive club. They were down there with their families, and they were run out. Now, mind you, this cabin was a favorite four-wheel drive destination for even members of the Sierra Club. I mean, the scouts, it was just a neat cabin along a stream at this old mining camp. And they decided that they couldn't have a structure for human occupation there because a wilderness is pristine without the imprint of man, where man is, quote, a visitor who does not remain. So if there was a cabin there where people were staying, that wouldn't qualify for wilderness. So to accommodate Dianne, and I can tell you that folks in the Sierra Club there, I know them well, I'm a member, I've been a member of the Sierra Club for years, and I can tell you that Joyce Burke and the Desert Committee worked hand-in-glove with the Forest Service to blow this thing up.
They blew it up, huh?
They packed it full of ammonium nitrate, C4 explosives, and vaporized the cabin. And I finally got the 700 Club, Pat Robertson's news service, to come out from Washington, D.C. a couple years after it happened to document all of this, and perhaps 100 million people have seen this story as part of the war in the West on their network, which goes all over the world. And, of course, the road had been rebuilt because we sicked Jesse Helms and Congressman Jerry Lewis and several other congressmen on the Forest Service. And, in fact, they came up on, after they blew the cabin up, they came up on my family's mining property claims, where I had a permit to operate, drill, and do some core drilling, and used an existing public road, RS-2477 road, and they put explosives in four different locations. The first three, they vaporized about 10 tons, creating huge tank traps in the road. And then last place, it was getting late on a Saturday evening, so apparently they took all the explosives they had, and they blasted about 40 tons they vaporized. But the hot shrapnel from the explosives sprayed into the tender dry forest. Now, mind you, this isn't September. On the 14th, in the height of fire season, at that time there was a six-year drought. There was a maximum buildup of fuel because there had never been historic fire in that region. So after they blasted this, the hot shrapnel lodged in the pinyon pine trees and mountain mahogany and other vegetation, and the Marines and the Forest Service left. They went home. In fact, they didn't even block the road, so that later a kid on a Jeep came through and almost killed himself driving off the road. But all night long, dozens of fires, maybe even hundreds of little fires, burned. 18 hours later, they were coalescing into a larger fire. And a motorist saw the smoke and called the forestry in Big Bear Lake. And they sent the state forestry and U.S. Forest Service fire suppression folks out. And they put the fire out. And because of our concern about blowing up a public road, they were forced to rebuild the road. Now, that cost the taxpayers on the order of $200,000 to put the fire out and to rebuild the road. And the archaeologist, Marilyn, who was a friend of mine for the Forest Service, she told me she was ordered to take this D6 dozer, dig a slit trench, and bury the remains of the historic cabin so it wouldn't be seen.
So everything, of course, is just to harass the people, and with this insane concept of sustainable development motivating what goes on. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is another aspect of the Wildlands Project. That cabin site now is in the Bighorn Wilderness, which was passed by Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer's Desert Wilderness Act in 1994.
Okay, we're going to just ask you to hang up. We're going to try you back on the other line again, see if we can get a little better line. Okay, I'll call you back in just a moment.
Okay, great.
Well, let's try. Well, would you try another line? This is really terribly distracting. Terrible buzz. Yeah, what is it? All right, we'll call you right back. Try 714-731-1335. Well, Dr. Stan, we're going to see if we can get a better line there. We've got a terrible, terrible hum on the line, which is very distracting. But apparently what you're hearing is what happened to a gentleman who has private property, and of course they seem to have a desire to prevent him from utilizing his property. This whole idea of sustainable development, we're going to drive people off the land, we're going to make everything half a property, wilderness. Another half is going to be border areas, another quarter, and then, of course, we're going to have the people living in the remaining 25% of the land. Well, to the average individual, this seems rather absurd, but it's only absurd when it's happening to somebody else. When it happens to you, why, of course, you begin to understand what this is about. Now, they plan to use sustainable development and substitute the word socialism, meaning taking your property. That's sustainable development. They plan to control the water. They plan to control every aspect of our lives. And unfortunately, they're getting away with it because the good people are doing nothing. Don, are you there?
Still here.
All right, now that is a good line. Thank you so much. We've finally got away from that awful hum. So anyway, of course, they had to rebuild the road. They had to put the fire out. And then what happened? Are you able to do anything about these really brutal people? These are sort of people, if they'd been in Germany, they would have been in charge of the death camps, you know. They have no concern about human beings or human rights. They want to have an agenda, and they're going to carry it out.
Well, I think there's a case here for reincarnation from the Nazi SS. I wonder if there hasn't been a reincarnation, because the surliness of some of these folks is just like the Nazis were. But to continue the story, interestingly enough, I have a letter of apology that Rebecca Oz, a district ranger, sent, apologizing for blowing up my road. And actually, it's a public road, not just my road, and starting the forest fire and apologizing for any inconvenience. She's so out to lunch that she added at the back bottom of her letter, trying to make me look bad, said, "You can't be down there drilling," because I had to complain I was down there drilling. But I had a permit to do that. A few months before, her and I had been out there discussing it. She said, out to lunch, she was trying to make me a criminal. That's what they always tried to do. But anyway, I do have the letter of apology. It's dated the 11th of December, 1991, as I recall. And they had rebuilt the road. Now, a few months later, there are allegedly endangered plants that they were nominated for listing at the time. Parrish's Daisy and another one, which your listeners might remember this. It was called Cushionberry Milkvetch. Well, that's a red flag, because milkvetch is actually the genus Stragalus. It is locoweed, and it is against state law and county ordinance to knowingly propagate this on your property. I even checked with the San Bernardino County weed abatement people. And basically, it's a poisonous, noxious plant, which if devoured by mammals, causes delusions, blindness, birth defects, spontaneous abortion, and even death in mammals, including humans. Well, the Forest Service got this plant listed. It's now a felony to pick it up or to touch it, subject to 5 years in a federal penitentiary and up to a $100,000 fine. However, it's against the county ordinance, so you can be charged with a misdemeanor for not removing it from your property. So if you're clearing a fire break around your house, cabin, ranch, business, you could actually be committing a federal felony. You might be following the state law if this local weed is there. In fact, it was a local weed that shut down the Allegheny's Dunes, allegedly an endangered weed that was being hurt by off-road people down at the Allegheny's Dunes east of the Salton Sea 2 years ago Thanksgiving. That's just another red herring. It was the Pearson's Milkvetch, Astragalus magdaleni variety pearsoni. And the county's been trying to eradicate it for years down there in the farm areas. I call up the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a friend of mine who's a manager for Indian reservations. I ask him if it was on their noxious weed list. So he said, well, what's the scientific name? So I gave it to him, and he came back on the phone actually screaming in my ear. He says, my God, Fife, he says, I've got six people right now that do nothing but drive around and spray those plants, not only on Indian reservations in Southern California, but on the surrounding Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service lands. So here we have two arms of the same government agency, the Department of Interior, one, the BIA, killing it, and you've got the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and BLM and all their environmental allies, quote, trying to save it.
Well, it's just like the Fish and Wildlife clubbing the salmon, you know, and then saying, look at the salmon shortage. And because all of these things seem so absurd, unless you understand that we're living in a world gone mad, and it appears that the occupants of the insane asylum are in charge.
Well, you may have seen my article, I think, Well-Intended Law Gone Local. That's how I ended adds new meaning to the old adage that the inmates are in charge of the asylum. Now, the Forest Service, of course, is marching on with their weed and toad sanctuary. They've proposed to publish in the Federal Register to withdraw the heart of the limestone province in Lucerne Valley, 44,575 acres, for mineral withdrawal. They have already put out of business Riverside Cement's Parton operation, which was a large operation, and it's a weed and toad sanctuary now.
All right, fine, but aren't they required by law to compensate people if they take valuable property from them?
Well, that's on the books. The problem is you have to have a good lawyer, at least $1 million, and live long enough to get to the Supreme Court, because they fight you tooth and nail.
With our own tax money,
of course. Our own tax money. Now, I did sue them when they put me in wilderness, when Clinton signed the wilderness bill. The Sierra Club had drawn the lines. In fact, it was kind of insulting. In order to get the wilderness boundary maps, you had to pay the Sierra Club $120 to get a set of the maps, which they had, quote, copyrighted. And Dianne Feinstein had actually included those maps as part of the S-21 Desert Wilderness Act in 1994. But those were all drawn by members of the Sierra Club. Judy Anderson was the chair of the Desert Committee. I know Judy quite well. I think she's a math teacher. She's a nice person. But she's out to lunch.
The only way to deal with these people would be to, get a lawyer who wanted to make some money and go after the environmentalists on a RICO suit, because what they are doing is a criminal activity to take away people's private property. And it's not just one time, it's over and over and over again. It's repeated efforts and, of course, misusing science. As you well know, they come up with phony junk science, whether it's up in the Klamath Basin or wherever it is. And until somebody brings lawsuits against the environmentalists, they're going to continue running roughshod over the freedom of the people of this country.
Well, their flagship endangered weed, and I call these endangered weeds because they're invader species. You have to disturb the ground by removing the vegetation either by fire or physically with a bulldozer, like in a fire break, for these plants to expand. Now, they claim they only grow on limestone. Well, that they're now getting away from that because they're starting to find that they're growing on other things. Now, one of the mining companies that's operating over for their steelworker operation, they had a little posy plantation where they planted two of these endangered weeds on granite in a road cut, and they had Rancho Santa Botanical Gardens botanists do this in a scientific manner. All the plants have numbers on them, and they're thriving in granite. Now get this, the Forest Service botanist who did the listing package, Miley Neal, she got very upset because the U.S. Bureau of Mines and USGS geologists were telling her that these plants grew on things other than limestone. So she went out and sampled the substrate, analyzed them, and some of the analyses are the analysis of granite, and she doesn't know the difference. She's the author of the listing package.
Now, Rob, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with Don, and we'll invite your calls here at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, why, we But appreciate your giving serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us do what we do, and that is, of course, bring the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and the historical understanding of what's really going on in the world today. And so if you believe that we are in a very deep trouble, that there is an organized effort to undermine the fabric of a free society using the environmental movement. They're not interested in all this vegetation or the red-legged frog or call it what you will. They're interested in control. And these people are the ultimate in hypocrites, but they've got these crazy laws in place. Congress didn't even know what they were enacting, and what we need is to get some congressmen in there and get rid of all of this. You have to understand that this whole environmental movement is funded by people of great wealth who want to control everything and really want to force people into controlled, what they call sustainable communities, where they can be watched and monitored, at least those that they will allow to live. And if you don't think that there is a world genocidal policy going on today, you've never read Jacques Cousteau's statement in the November 1991 UNESCO Courier, in which he says we've got to eliminate 350,000 people a day. If you'd like a copy of it, give us a call, or go to your library and get it, or we'll be glad to send you one. They'll give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Go to my website. You can read my Population Control Agenda monograph, but if you want the original, it's right there. They really intend to kill off most of the people in the world, but of course they're going to need a justification. Well, maybe a bacteriological attack by the wicked Saddam Hussein or the wicked Osama bin Laden might do the trick. And you say that's preposterous? Well, of course, say that to the people of Africa who are dying in large numbers from an AIDS epidemic, and we're fighting it just as hard as we can. In fact, we've saved half the people in Botswana. Only half of the women between 20 and 35 are now HIV infected. But of course, we're using the same failed approach to the epidemic to try to protect the uninfected half that we've used that has led to the direct infection of half the population. And of course, in Africa, this disease is far more infectious than it is here in the United States because it has a susceptibility for the black population. But nobody ever wants to call this genocide. Well, maybe we ought to. And of course, here in the United States, we know what happened to the homosexuals who volunteered for the original hepatitis B cohort in San Francisco. And we have this, actually, you get Randy Schill's book and the band played on, and you read it and you'll find that 80% of the homosexuals who volunteered for that study, oh shucks, they just happened to come down with AIDS. Isn't that too bad? What was it? It was in the vaccine that was used in San Francisco. And, of course, I suspect it was in the vaccines that were used in Africa. Why it's selective and why we have not one epidemic but about eight different HIV epidemics, because it's all different strains, and all those strains did not come from one monkey bite. And of course, this all fits into sustainable development, what we're talking about tonight. If you think there's a problem, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, or give us a call at 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, our guest this evening is Don Fife, and he's been on the front lines of this battle for many years. Well, Don, a lot of these things happened a long time ago. What's going on today as far as your mind is concerned?
Well, I will give a little background, and I did sue them when this. I sued, the Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Agriculture, and 27 other Forest Service and U.S. Geological Survey personnel, including the Forest Supervisor, Gene Zimmerman, whose baby this Sweden Toad Sanctuary is. And I sued them for all of those things you were mentioning, civil rights, Fifth Amendment, and RICO. And also, there's something that maybe your listeners should be aware of, that there's a tough clause in NAFTA, a Fifth Amendment taking clause, which calls for immediate compensation for either regulatory taking or taking of your property. Now, that's in NAFTA. It was meant to protect big corporations, basically, but it applies to American citizens here. as well as in Canada or Mexico. So when I filed this lawsuit and I put out a press release, it was published locally all over, and suddenly the Forest Service came to me and said, well, gee, maybe those lines aren't set in stone after all. So they did move the lines where I was applying for a permit over 3,000 feet. They still left some of the ore body in the wilderness. So then I continued applying for operating plan. And there was a mine there previously, but I had spent years, my family had putting enough property together to justify an operation, drilling and doing geology. And the mine was started originally in 1949. But what I discovered was the Forest Service, Irene Rice, the wilderness planner for BLM, and the Forest Service, they used a 1947 map, which didn't show my mine, and didn't show the Riverside Parton mine either, because they started in 1960. So they submit these maps to Congress for wilderness bills on out-of-date maps that are 30, maybe 40 years out of date, when new maps are available showing them. So anyway, I did get some results, but they, unbeknownst to me, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, Joyce Burke of the Audubon Society, and Sally Pearson with the San Bernardino Valley Audubon, and the State Parks Recreation, Off-Road Vehicle Recreation Fund, which gives about $20 million a year to the BLM and Forest Service, largely for off-road vehicles, they signed an agreement to destroy all of my roads, my test quarries, as well as my neighbors, provided that the Forest Service would be able to build recreation trails on the south side of the valley, Lone Valley, where I'm at. And interestingly enough, the only place the Forest Service found the endangered weeds was on the north side where I and my neighbors were, and claimed that there weren't any on the south side. I mean, it was so bad on the 1996 field trip the Forest Service had for the State Off-Road Vehicle Commissioners to get a $100,000 grant for a staging area. An old Forest Service quarry is the best site for their flagship endangered weed, the so-called cushionberry buckwheat, or cushion buckwheat, oval leaf buckwheat, a variety of Vineum they claim is unique to the San Bernardino Mountains. Well, Ruth Winstrom and Gail Vanderbee, Forest Service staff, they parked the State Off-Road Vehicle Commissioners, Jeeps and four-wheel drive vehicles, and other vehicles, right on top of the best population of their endangered weeds, crunching them.
Now, wait a minute. Isn't that a criminal offense?
Oh, yeah. It's a felony.
It's a felony. Well, now, did you bring charges against them for doing that? Did you get pictures and all?
Oh, I have pictures. Actually, I believe he was the chairman of the State Off-Road Vehicle Commission. He was a friend of mine. He drove up, parked up next to me where we were directed to park, and I said, hey, Ed, my God, you just ran over the endangered cushionberry buckwheat. He says, what do they look like? And I said, well, let's see, there's one, two, three. My God, Ed, you ran over 10 of them. That's up to 50 years in the federal penitentiary. He says, my God, Fife, stop taking photographs. So I went to the group where they were going to get the pitch on why they needed to, I think it was like $100,000 to use this as a staging area for the east end of a 100-mile trail from Cajon Pass to the east side of the forest. And it was actually a nice, logical place to have it. It was a Forest Service old road material quarry. And they had cleared all the vegetation off and abandoned it as they scraped down to hard rock. And the invading species were 15 to 20% of them were these endangered, allegedly endangered cushionberry buckwheat. Now, mind you, if you look at the literature, and we pointed this out to Fish and Wildlife in 93 when they were going to list these, this plant, Erigonium oleifolium, subspecies, or actually it's a variety, the NAM. The birds are eating the seeds, Stan. They're eating them and spreading them up and down the Pacific flyway from Canada to Mexico. In fact, we've found that they grow up to 11,500 feet in subarctic conditions in the Sierras and in the San Bernardino Mountains. They probably grow all the way to the Arctic Circle. And they grow up and down the Rocky Mountains and the Great Basin. And the birds are eating the seeds and spreading it. But the Forest Service excuse here is that these plants are relic populations from the last ice age, and they're genetically unique. Bull fucky. The birds eat the seeds. I see them eating the seeds. So you know birds eat seeds like this, and they're in total denial. In fact, they're in shock when I ever mention this at a meeting or hearing.
But you have to understand, these people are not stupid. These people want to take the property, and they're using, whether it's this piece of vegetation or the spotted owl or the marble marlet or the red-legged frog. These people really don't care about the animals. They care about getting you off the property and taking the property. When until people recognize that, we play their game, we lose. If we point out the hypocrisy of what they're doing and their real objective, then of course they can't stand the light of day.
Well, but you're wrong. They love the plants because they're out there planting them on my property. I have a sworn affidavit from a Forest Service employee, or ex-employee now, that they had the volunteers collect seeds, and then they spread them on my property, my neighbor's property, with a seed spreader that apparently was bought with state money.
Now, of course, this is criminal activity.
It is criminal activity.
And so what have you been able to do with the lawsuit on us?
Well, now, I mean, I'm just an individual. I don't have $1 million to sue them. However, I have documented this, and at some point, my lawsuit, incidentally, I withdrew it when they moved the boundaries so I could operate. But then they continued to harass me. Then I catch them planting the endangered plants on. Now I've been before Senate and House committees. And in fact, January of this year, Congressman Pombo from Stockton on the House floor on the 24th of January pointed out to 434 other congressmen that they were doing this to me. He says, if you think planting lynx hares on the forest in eastern Washington, Canadian lynx hares, to get the areas closed is bad. Well, there's the case of Donald Fife, a scientist geologist in the San Bernardino National Forest, that was told by Forest Service officials that seeds listed in the ESA were planted to close 30,000 acres. Well, it's now up to 44,575 acres. We actually have a photograph, several years old, of one of the former Forest Service botanist planting some of the endangered plants, not this particular group that's the limestone endemic, but two others, in a gold mining area. We have a photograph on a Sierra Club-type field trip. We have the guidebook. We have the photograph. Newspaper article documents there was a trip. But ironically, we recently found that this guy wrote an article bragging about doing it bragging said that these were listed by the state in 1980 and by the feds in, I think, 1984. The guy's planting these endangered plants, and now Supervisor Gene Zimmerman wants to close the area to mineral entry to save the endangered plants. I mean, this is criminal activity.
But you see, these people have no respect for private property or for individual freedom. They have a different worldview. And until such time as, we can take the government's money away, until we can strip them of the ability to employ these people and force them to go out and get an honest job, they're going to continue harassing our people.
Well, that's true. Now, I think I might have sent you a little press release I put out because I was doing some core drilling after Mr. Pombo, or Congressman Pombo, brought this to light. Suddenly the Forest Service couldn't sign my permits fast enough to drill and explore and so forth. So they've been signing permits. Well, I was out doing some core drilling late last year, before December, and I had hired a former Forest Service chief geologist as my consultant here. He's been retired for about 10 years, but he knows the regulations backwards and forwards. And so we were driving down to get some water for the little drill rig and at this ranch nearby, and I saw this Forest Service guy with a couple of gals planting native vegetation in my road, digging holes and putting in little mountain mahogany plants and little Joshua trees, Yucca brevifolia, and so forth. So I stopped. I suspect he thought we must be with the Forest Service because he'd been driving by us for several days, and there was a green Forest Service truck parked where we were drilling, because the Forest Service was observing what we were doing. And so I said, "Say, could I videotape your restoration of this road?" And he says, "Sure, I don't see any, no problem." And I had mentioned a certain plants he was growing, so he figured I was probably with the Forest Service, but I introduced myself. I didn't hide anything, and I introduced my consultant, the former Forest Service chief geologist, and so I videotaped him digging little holes, and this gal's dragging old dead tree limbs and stuff into this road, but it was an access road to my property. I didn't mention that to him. And so just before I left, I said, well, gee, are you planting any of those endangered plants? And he said, no, he wasn't. And obviously he was planting plants that came from a nursery, native plant nursery. Anyway, I said, well, you know, how can these buckwheat, this Ergonoma litholeum, the NAM, and this Stragglus albans locoweed, how can they be endangered? Every time you dig a fire break or there's a wildland fire, they come back like gangbusters. Now, his comment was, oh, everybody knows they're not really endangered. We just need them to stop mining. Well, my cohort's mouth dropped open. A couple weeks later, we were in Spokane telling a story to a deputy chief of the Forest Service. But they, just like you say, they know that these aren't. This was a young kid that had recently graduated from a university in eastern Indiana. In fact, I told him, well, I used to go to the University of Dayton, and we used to play you guys. And he says, oh, yeah, the Flyers just beat the hell out of us. So he kind of thought I was one of them, I guess, but the poor guy probably didn't make probation.
But you see, these people have no respect for private property.
Absolutely.
They don't understand that there is no freedom if there's no private property. You know, maybe they don't have any property now, but what they're ensuring is they will never own anything, nor will they ever be free, because they have become part of this organized effort to oppress the rights of the people.
Well, they sure have been doing a number. Oh, incidentally, in the
now, what did you ever do with this video? Have you ever been able to utilize that? I would think that if you could utilize that in a lawsuit, you could, own the Forest Service.
Well, I have a book, and incidentally, my lawsuit can be reinstated at any time. And of course, right now they're trying to make me happy by giving me permits to mine, which
they're not trying to make you happy. They're trying to close your road down.
Well, that's true there. That's true right there.
I mean, you can't compromise with evil, and this is what you're doing. It seems to me that you keep compromising, and well, if they just give me a little something, I'll back away, and then as soon as you back away, why they come right after you again? Until you recognize that they're never going to leave you alone and you're going to have to defeat them totally, you're going to just be in this period of chronic frustration, and eventually they're going to win because you're going to give up and move out. You can't keep up. Only by defeating them totally is there any way, of ending this harassment, not only for yourself, but for everybody in that region. Isn't there anybody there? Don't the people really care? Are they willing to just let them pick you off one at a time and everybody sort of backs down? Well, maybe you'll give us a little goodie for a time being. And then, I mean, here you say that they're giving you the permits and then they're closing your road. They know what they're doing.
Well, it was a road to another area, but the... I understand what you're saying. Now,
right.
What my disappointment here is that the large corporations are just rolling over.
Well, of course they are. The larger corporations, most of them are going right along with this. I mean, many of the major corporations are funding this whole thing. I don't know which corporations you're speaking of, but I will tell you the funding for the whole environmental movement comes from people of great wealth and from America's corporations.
Well, there's Ron Arnold's book, Undue Influence, which has
That's a nice
little list, and Trashing the Economy is even more specific in many cases. So, the fellow Gene Zimmerman, the forest supervisor, he's the guy that was instrumental in closing up the Columbia Gorge and running the private property people out of that area.
And until these people realize they're going to lose their jobs for doing this sort of thing, that the people aren't going to put up with it, at least up in the Klamath Basin, the people got together, and forced them to back down.
Exactly.
And, of course, that's the only thing you can do. How many families are involved in this harassment?
Well, they've reduced this down to a couple of dozen, and people are not, you know, they don't have the resources to fight back. The only way I've been fighting back then is the fact that I have a, you know, a technical background, and
but isn't there anybody with the leadership to get everybody together and to pool your resources and go after them?
Well, the largest donor, actually, it's being hurt, is the Cushenberry Mine Trust, which is the FFL-CIO health insurance fund that owns all Kaiser's former Kaiser's limestone properties they got in the bankruptcy. And we have been somewhat working together.
No, it's just a shame that the people there don't value their freedom enough that they're willing to stand together. And this is the old technique of divide and conquer. And, of course, it sounds like they've done a great job of it.
Well, they've been working on it for a long time there.
Well, unless you go on the offensive and really go on the offensive, and, you know, every time you win a lawsuit and they give you a little kernel of, you know, a pat you on the back, why, as long as you keep backing down, you're going to lose.
Well,
you never should have dropped that lawsuit.
Well, the lawsuit has just been withdrawn. It is not dropped.
Well, but you withdrew it, and, you know, may not be dropped, but they got what they want. And until, you know, the one thing they fear is an angry group of people. The one thing they fear is lawsuits that will expose the hypocrisy of what they're doing. You drop the lawsuit, you let them off the hook. You really did. I mean, you can't keep, you know, well, if you give me a little tiny permit here, you know, maybe I can get some drilling done. But they're not going to. They'll make a concession and they'll come back again, which is exactly what they did, isn't it? You were even telling me that they had a forestry truck out there watching your drilling.
Well, actually, the forestry, the agency that took over the project was beneficial. They actually told the San Bernardino National Forest they had that I had to go into production to prove that the property was valuable. So they actually, I am mining there now. But I've been fighting back politically, and I've been keeping book on them legally. They've taken some pretty good hits here, but there could be a nice lawsuit in the making here. I have a lawsuit, which I update all the time.
Well, I think that you ought to bring it, and the one thing that they fear would be public exposure. And you know, but they're doing this to people all over the country. I mean, I hear that people, you know, the lumbering people, they can't use their the wood that they have. They insist you can't lumber there, and of course you get the overgrowth and you get a fire. The wood's all burned up. And, of course, whether it be that or whether it's be clubbing the salmon or taking away people's property rights, you know, because they're too close to a waterway. And the people all across the country are just letting them get away with it. This is what's so infuriating.
Well, you know, this Cushenberry buckwheat grows in the California Coast Ranges. You may have it there in APTA.
We probably do. I'm sure we have, you know. But then, of course, they've set aside you know, a quarter of a million acres here in the state of California, something like that, because they're areas where the red-legged frog might want to be. And, they're not that there are any there, but they might want to be there.
Oh, I understand.
And of course, this has nothing to do with a red-legged frog. It has to do with seizing property rights. And until the people really care about freedom, the other side's going to keep winning.
Well, I of course feel that the so-called Endangered Species Act, which has its genesis with the UN treaties, simply needs to be repealed. That
Absolutely.
Would solve a lot of problems.
Absolutely, but of course the only way it's going to be repealed is when you have enough responsible people in Congress who will take a stand. And of course most of these people are afraid to take a stand for fear the government will come after them, as they did with George Hansen, and sent him to prison unjustifiably and ruined his political career and ruined his life and actually physically tortured him. And where were the rest of the congressmen when it happened? Why, they wouldn't even stand up for poor old George, because they were afraid they'd come after them. And instead of going to the people and making a fuss about it, why, they've knuckled under too.
No,
anyway,
I remember that case quite well.
Right, you remember George Hansen, or the congressman from Idaho?
Idaho, right. Now, I remember his Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which we generated as much support as we could.
Well, anyway, what's your message you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, I think that people need to be involved and find out what's going on out there. You know, if you don't know what's going on, I don't think there's any real reason to go vote, frankly. You need to know who the candidate is and what he stands for.
Well, as long as they're going to go into electronic voting, why bother? I think we ought to demand paper ballots, number one, to do away with the electronic voting, because once you have electronic voting, why your vote is totally useless. You don't know anything at all about the machines. None of us know anything about the machines, and they can be rigged. I will tell you that in our region where I live, why, there's a fellow who actually works for the Peace and Freedom Party. That's the communist movement here. They're in charge of the voting right here in Santa Cruz where I live. So, I mean, do you honestly think you're going to get an honest vote? Of course you're not. Well, the people, if they really cared, they'd be demanding that we get, you know, go back to paper ballots, keep those ballots in the precinct, and get away from all of this rigging of elections that we have all across America today. Yet nobody really cares. As long as things are good, everybody just goes along to get along. And until the American people value freedom, why, they will never have it. And I fear that we are all going to lose it because of the apathy and indifference of the American people today.
Well, that's it, the apathy. There's a lot of information out there. You mentioned some of your publications, your tapes, and so forth. I'm sure you're familiar with The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's one of my favorites.
Sure, and certainly Ron Arnold's book, the one you spoke of. We have Burning Rage, the story of Barry Clausen's book. We still carry that. We think it's a very, very important book going to the corruption within the environmental movement. And there's so many good books out there, certainly Trashing the Planet, Environmental Overkill by Dixie, Right. Anyway, what are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening? We're just about out of time.
Well, it's get involved, get the message out, find out what smart growth is all about, which is the sustainable development, socialism, the Wildlands Project. I think if the American people knew what was going on, this stuff would come to a screeching halt. And, of course, a lot of the sources from these UN treaties which bypass Congress.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it, Don. Keep us appraised of what you're doing.
Okay.
Good night. God bless you. Oh, this is Dr. Stan. And it's just so infuriating to see these things going on. And, of course, I think Mr. Fife's done a good job. But, of course, you can't back down on these people. You show any weakness, they'll come after you again because they're not nice people. And the only way this is ever going to be changed if enough people are willing to get involved, what are you willing to do to help us? And if you're willing to get involved, why, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and say, I want to help, what can I do? And we'll tell you what you can do. Well, I'll get off my soapbox. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Could have been one of the best, greatest tapes of all time.